Good morning. I think I'll get started. Really delighted to have all of you here and to share the work that we are doing. I'm going to provide a little bit of context for the papers that you're going to hear today based on the program that we've been working on for about 15 years called the Healthy Youths Program. And I'll introduce myself. I'm Jerry Donenberg. I'll moderate this session. I'm a professor in the Department of Medicine and the Associate Dean of Research in the School of Public Health. And I have here with me my colleagues, Ms. Erin Emerson, who is the Associate Director of the Healthy Youths Program and manages all the data-related aspects. I have Dr. Wadia Udell, who is an associate professor at the University of Washington on the Bothell campus, and also the assistant dean of faculty affairs. And then we have Dr. Nikki Floyd, who is a research scientist in the School of Public Health and was the director of the project from which some of these data will be presented. And then there are other collaborators on our presentations who you'll see as we progress. So the Healthy Youths Program has been in existence for about 15 years, and we have been funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, as well as the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. And I'm just going to mention that Faith Fletcher just came in, and she's also one of the authors of the papers that we're presenting. Dr. Faith Fletcher is an assistant professor in the Community Health Sciences Division of the School of Public Health. So the Healthy Youths Program, established in 2001, has done a variety of work, both in basic research studies, and these are just the selection that I have here for you. Some of them you'll be hearing about some papers later today, this morning. We have also done a number of adapted interventions for different populations, including psychiatric populations, therapeutic day school populations, juvenile offenders. We've done work in Rwanda, we've done work in South Africa, and so we have a lot of experience sort of taking interventions and adapting them for new populations, and using the basic research that you see up there, those studies, to inform those interventions. We also have worked across multiple sites, Rhode Island, Emory with my colleagues there, as well as in different international sites. And then, importantly to us, we have also been a hub for a lot of training of young people and young scholars, both graduate students, as well as faculty. And in particular, we have a strong emphasis on capacity building among underrepresented minorities, particularly African American and some Latinos. And you can see here of the training and education we've provided to our scholars, 50% of them have been from underrepresented minority groups. So the mission statement for our program is to empower youth and families from diverse and traditionally underserved populations so that they can lead safer, risk-free lives. And that's through promoting health and creating awareness and also working in their communities. But secondly, we have a strong commitment to reflect the diversity and the strengths of the community we serve. So that comes into place when we talk about why we focus so much on working with underrepresented minority scholars who will then develop programs of research of their own to go on and work with these kinds of research questions. We also, just to give you a sense, have a large selection of community collaborators. This just reflects some of them, not all of them, but very proud to say that, you know, lots of involvement from our community collaborators, other university collaborators, in service of this, of the work that we do. And in particular, the outpatient mental health clinics have really been very supportive and collaborative in our work. So overall, in the last 15 years, I just want to give you a snapshot. We have had about 5,700 participants across all of our projects. About 3,700 of those have actually received some sort of intervention, which we're really proud of. 77% of the participants in our work are generally Black or African American, and about 53% are female. We also work mostly with low-income urban populations, and you can see here that about 67% of our participants are youth, which means the other percentage, we work with caregivers, because we have a large emphasis on strengthening interpersonal relationships in order to reduce risk and promote health. 61% of our population has been recruited directly from mental health settings, whether therapeutic day schools. So we have a strong emphasis on mental health, which I'll explain in a minute. And we also have a presence in two different countries in Africa. So why do we focus so much on youth, and why do we focus on mental health? And for some of you, this might be redundant, hopefully not for most of you. But the reason we focus on youth is because they really are the burgeoning population at risk for sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV. So even though they represent 25% of all people who are sexually experienced, they actually represent 50% of all new sexually transmitted infections reported annually. So they're, and we know that sexually transmitted infections make one more vulnerable to HIV, although that is also a sexually transmitted infection. And in fact, most teenagers acquire HIV through risky sexual behavior. I'll talk in a minute. 60% of those youth are unaware of their HIV status. And the reason that's really critical now is we know that the sooner someone knows they're HIV positive, the sooner we get them on treatment, the less likely they will be to transmit the virus, and the more likely they will be to have a long, productive, healthy life. So that, you know, if the medications are taken well and consistently, people no longer die of HIV-related issues, they die of other ones. And right before this session, I think there was a session on PrEP, and that's another example, pre-exposure. But we also know that there are significant health disparities in HIV. And our interest has really been on Black African Americans, and particularly Black women. So when we talk about HIV risk, and partly what I'm trying to do here is give you a context that will then lead to the rest of the conversations that you'll hear later, because I think this will help frame what you're going to hear about. When we talk about HIV or AIDS risk behaviors, we're talking about the behaviors that actually put someone at risk for getting HIV. So it's not that people have HIV, it's that having sex without a condom, having sex with multiple partners, early sexual initiation, sex while using drugs or alcohol can compromise safer sex behaviors, and of course, any injection drug behavior can also more directly lead to HIV transmission. But primarily for youth, it's through risky sex. And so you want to keep that in mind when we talk about how we're doing health promotion activities. Now, why mental health? Well, it's become very clear now that mental health and mental illness is related to HIV transmission in a number of different ways. We see people with mental illness engaging in more risky behavior, less condom use, more drug use that compromises safer sex. People with mental illness have poor health promotion in general. They have poor health. They don't take their medications. They don't engage in healthy eating or exercise. We know that when it comes to HIV in particular, being infected, they're less likely to adhere to the antiretroviral regimen. And then we also see that with people who have mental health problems, when you engage them in behavioral interventions, they're less likely to be responsive to those. So you see a difference in who responds to those interventions. So that if we could actually treat mental illness, whether in the context of HIV or in general, we're going to more effectively reduce new transmissions and improve adherence to ART. So this is just a little bit of a, this is just to give you a sense that I don't know if you can see it very well, but the white bar is really what we see in the general population, at least as of 2010, in terms of high risk or sexual risk-taking behavior. So, and the point of this slide is to show that the more vulnerable youth through mental health or juvenile justice are engaging in more risky behaviors than the general population youth. And so that's one of the reasons we really focus on kids who are at high risk and particularly vulnerable. Several of those bars reflect mental health samples and so forth. So teenagers in particular engage in the same behaviors as their peers. We see that, but they do it at higher rates. So and when we try to understand why that's the case, we see that kids with mental health issues have a poorer assessment of the risks involved in their behavior. They tend to not evaluate risks well, and they overlook certain risks that they might not if they weren't depressed or they weren't acting out and impulsive. Similarly, some of them have irrational thinking. We see kids, you know, making connections. I've had youth say, well, I knew she couldn't be infected because she was wearing Nike sneakers. And so, you know, things like that, there's sort of irrational thoughts about how you make those connections. We also see that kids with mental health issues have cognitive deficits. In large part, they might have missed school, because of their mental illness. And those cognitive deficits make it harder when you know what you're supposed to do to link that with the behavior that you should enact, right? So even if you have knowledge about what you should do to prevent or transmission, it's much harder to sort of act on those. Similarly, kids with mental health issues have many interpersonal problems, both with their families and their peers, and that's something you're going to hear about more today because that's something we're especially interested in. We believe that if you can strengthen those interpersonal relationships, you can actually promote better health outcomes for these youth. And then lastly, there is a lack of assertiveness, particularly around sort of depressed youth and girls who, if you are worried about maintaining a relationship, you might be less willing to assert yourself in a relationship that insists on condom use. So we have typically taken a much broader theoretical framework to our understanding of risk for adolescents. And these are, you know, generally the characteristics that we focus on. You will be hearing specifically today about the family characteristics, peers, and partners. And we're going to present data from three different study samples. One is a sample of juvenile offenders and the sample is primarily African American and Black, only about 32% female, and you'll hear about some of that from Dr. Udell. There's also a sample we call Girl Talk, which is of African American and Black females and young women, 12 to 16 years old at baseline, and their caregivers, which I will be presenting on. And then the third study you'll hear about is our study of Girl Talk, We Talk, which is really focused on African-American Black females and their sort of history of trauma and exposure to violence in relation to partner intimate violence and risky behavior as we move forward. So just to reiterate, Dr. Udell and her colleague Erica Bridian are going to discuss the sort of relationship between peer influence and adolescent risk-taking by exploring profiles among juvenile offenders who use drugs during sex. Dr. Floyd, with her collaborator, Dr. Wilson, who isn't here because she just had two babies, are going to discuss the gender-related power imbalance in romantic relationships as a potential mediator of early violence and risk. And then myself and Dr. Fletcher are going to talk about the impact of the quality of mother-daughter sexual communication over the course of 2 years and how that relates to girls' risky sexual behavior. So I want to thank you for your attention and for being here. Okay, so quickly to acknowledge my co-authors on this presentation, as you see here, Dr. Fletcher and Mary Ellen McKesey-Amidi is in the audience, and Erin Emerson. So I have no financial relationships to disclose. So I want to start with my acknowledgments, actually, instead of putting those at the end, in large part because not just the National Institute of Mental Health, but probably most importantly, our mothers and daughters that have participated in this research over the many years, our mental health clinic administrators and staff, but especially our advisory board. We've had a Girl Talk advisory board that has been instrumental in what we have done with this population. And I think importantly, one of the issues that has come up for us over time is that this notion, I think, that Wadia talked about, that we tend to focus on the risks for these youth. and that when the girls report that they've had engaged in different sexual activity, the board was very concerned that we would be yet again making the statement that African American girls are risky and engage in risk behavior. Well, in fact, what we know is that they actually engage in less risky behavior than white populations. But because of the nature of their environment and their partners, it puts them at greater risk. And so we came to an agreement that everything that we publish on this group will have this disclaimer to make sure that people understand that they reflect self-reported behaviors of the girls that can place them at risk for HIV, but they don't necessarily represent either willing behavior or mostly consciously willing behavior. We do screen out the girls who report sexual abuse, but this was a compromise that we felt was really important to recognize. So you've heard a lot about this. I will just add that even in Chicago, 80% of Black and African American women with AIDS are 80% of the women with AIDS in Chicago are Black and African American. And I'd like to just reiterate what I noted, which is it's not necessarily a product of risky behavior, although that's what we often target in our interventions. It's really can be very structurally based. It can be a woman can have a single partner, and we see this in Africa as well, but that partner has multiple partners, and so he might be infecting multiple women, but that woman might have one monogamous relationship. So it should not be understood that this is a reflection of the women being risky. I do want to note within the ages of 13 to 19 years old, you can see that African Americans represent 17% of the population of this age range, and yet they represent 73% of HIV diagnoses. So again, major health disparities, which has driven much of the thinking about our work and the reason we do this work. So you've heard a bit about peer relationships in relation to risk, you've heard about romantic relationships in relationship to risk, and now I'm going to talk a little bit about the mother-daughter relationship and what it can do to mitigate risk. This is a theoretical model we have used a lot in our program to understand the more psychosocial context that youth experience that might put them at risk for negative health outcomes. We have here HIV risk, but it can be multiple health outcomes. And this really grows out of a sense early on where we really attributed much of HIV risk-taking behavior and prevention to cognitive factors, things like what you'll see more above with personal attributes on the left. You know, if you know how to prevent HIV and you believe you have the skills to do it and you have attitudes that you think it's important, then you will practice safer sex. Well, we know that hasn't panned out. And not that that's not important, that's certainly a building block and that's certainly part of the picture, but for youth, we felt that a much broader psychosocial context was important. They're embedded within families, they're embedded within peers, partner relationships, the environment, school, community, and so forth. So we also thought about where's the biggest bang for our buck in terms of intervention? Because most of what we've been doing was driven by how can we intervene to increase health promotion and reduce risk. So the ones in white, it's probably counterintuitive, but the ones in white are the pieces I'm going to talk about, not the parts in yellow, although we have published on multiple aspects of this model. So this is a sample we started recruiting probably in 2002 or 2003. They were 12 to 16-year-old African-American Black girls, self-identified, from mental health clinics all around the Chicago area. And we invited the youth, as the girls, as well as their female caregivers. And by female caregivers, it was whoever they felt was the primary person taking care of them. So you can see here that the majority were biological mothers, but we had 15% of them were grandmothers. We had a lot of aunts, and we had cousins, and so forth. So it was open to anyone. We also, so about 60% of these caregivers were younger than, or equal to 44 years old. So giving you a sense of who the caregivers were that participated. Obviously, 100% of them were female, mostly low to middle income, and the mean age at that baseline assessment was 14 and a half years old. This sample is what has driven the other studies that Nikki presented on Girl Talk, We Talk, and so forth. And so they have stayed with us probably about 10 years with significant breaks in recruitment or recontacting them because we didn't have funding to do so. But this particular project, actually, the initial study followed them over the course of 2 years. And you can see here that in addition to recruiting from multiple outpatient settings, we had excellent retention over time at 6 month, 12 month, 18 month, and 24 months. I will say we ran out of funding around 18 months, so there was a dip in terms of how to bring people back in and pay them. Each point that they came in, they were paid for their participation, and the amount increased over time to keep them engaged. But an 81% return rate at 24 months was pretty excellent. We're excited about that. Okay, so there is a much larger study of that, a longitudinal study, but I'm just going to focus on these particular measures. But I'm happy to answer questions about other measures that we've collected. As you know, there was a big focus on mental health, so we collected both parent and youth reports of internalizing and externalizing problems. For those of you who are not familiar with this nomenclature, externalizing refers to more aggressive, acting out, delinquent behaviors, the kind that bother everyone around them. Internalizing problems are more like depression and anxiety, the ones that you don't necessarily know are there unless you somehow can get it out of the youth. So we sort of looked at both of those constructs. We also looked, obviously, at our final outcome at 24 months with sexual behavior. And that included a composite score of multiple partners within the last 6 months, whether you had sex while using drugs or alcohol, whether you used condoms during vaginal sex, and whether you had sex with a high-risk partner, which generally meant there were lots of choices for a high-risk partner, but most of the youth said they didn't know the history, the sexual history of the person that they were having sex with. And then we collected a measure of mother-daughter communication that was adapted from a measure by Kim Miller, where we really wanted to understand whether youth and moms would report the quality of their communication. So there's a lot of research on frequency of communication. People talk a lot about, you know, talk to your kids all the time about sex, just talk to them and talk to them. Well, one of the potential confounds of that would be sort of, but how do you talk to them? Not just like, because we could ask someone, do you talk to your kid? Oh, yeah, I talk to my kid all the time. I tell him not to have sex. That's not a conversation, right? So there's some confusion in the literature around frequency versus quality of communication. And in fact, the data on frequency are quite mixed. And so in some cases you see parents who say, I talk, you know, more frequent communication, you see more risky sexual behavior, and less communication, you see more risky sexual behavior. And that is because in general, most of those studies are cross-sectional. So that's happening at the same time. So we have often thought, based on our own experiences, when parents learn that their kids are having sex, they start talking to them about it. So it's very hard to distinguish the frequency question. One of the exciting pieces of these data is the longitudinal pattern that we'll be talking about. So Mary Ellen, who's our analyst, did growth modeling analysis of the trajectories. And so we were looking at whether the trajectories of change of the relationship between parent open mother-daughter communication and sexual risk at two years later were related to each other over the course of 2 years, whether those trajectories changed. We also looked at some of the baseline mental health measures, externalizing problems, and sexual in relation to sexual risk. And then we tested the latent growth factors as predictors. So in terms of the baseline descriptives of this sample, just so you can have a sense of these 266 youth, 66% of them met threshold or sub-threshold criteria for a psychiatric diagnosis. So we did collect measures of, we did collect psychiatric diagnoses because it was a mental health sample. But one of the challenges of working with outpatient mental health samples is that many don't actually qualify for a diagnosis. They go in for other sorts of issues. And this is pretty consistent. This rate is pretty consistent with what you see in outpatient mental health samples. At baseline, 32% of the youth reported vaginal or anal sex. And that's really important because if you remember, this is an age group that's 12 to 16 years old and with a mean age of 14. That's a pretty high percentage having vaginal or anal sex in the sample. And then if you just look at those 86 girls who reported having vaginal or anal sex, you can see that 24% had more than had equal to or more than two partners within that past 6 months. They didn't use a condom consistently, and that they had had sex by or at the age, 86% had sex by the age of 14. So this is a representation of the growth model analysis that was done. And what I'm going to point out here is that on the left side and the middle are baseline variables. So on the left, you see the baseline mental health problems. The YSR externalizing problems mean that externalizing construct I talked about, but reported by youth. The CBCL was the same construct, but reported by parents. So you see both adolescents and parents are reporting on their mental health. And then what we did is we looked at whether that was related to mother-daughter communication, both from the daughter's perspective and the mother's perspective. So hopefully you can see that. And then their relationship with sexual risk-taking. So the easiest relationship to show you is from time one sexual risk to time five sexual risk. It's a pretty high correlation, right? So we expect that to be sort of consistent across time. Then, if you look, you can see that externalizing problems that were reported by both the mother and the daughter were related to sexual risk-taking. So the more that girls and moms reported that their daughters had externalizing mental health problems, the more likely they were to engage in sexual risk-taking at baseline. You can also see that these externalizing problems were associated with the mother's reports of open communication and girls' reports of open communication. So the more externalizing problems, the lower the quality of that communication, less open. Now, the part that's really important that I want to highlight is that what was really, really interesting is that the trajectories of those of mother-reported open communication over 2 years were predictive of sexual risk. So that as mother-daughter communication increased in openness over time, girls' sexual risk-taking was lower at 2 months. I mean, at 2 years. And the reason that that's so important is that we often think about, can mother-daughter communication, does it really matter over time, especially during this developmental period where girls are changing so much and, you know, puberty and all this stuff is happening? And in fact, what we show is that's really protective. And what's really good news about that is it points to very specific intervention implications. So if you can work with families and mothers and daughters to communicate openly and honestly, and you can empower the caregiver to teach and be a resource for their daughters, then that's protective. And particularly in African American Black families, where many are led by single women households. This is really good news for how we go on to protect our girls. So I kind of noted these findings as I was describing the figure, but I will note that girls' ratings of open communication were not related to sexual risk outcomes. So interestingly, it was parents' reports, but it's girls reporting on their own sexual risk-taking. So there was the nice piece there is you don't have that method variance that, well, what girls are just reporting similar things across time. So what we see as the next steps, and we have certainly pushed this in our own group, and you would see it in as we go back to talk about the Healthy Youth Program, is that we really strongly believe that families need to be involved in HIV and sexual risk reduction efforts. That when you work with youth on their own, you lose an opportunity to really leverage the parent-child relationship. And, you know, as interventionists, which we are in our group, we're only there for a very short period of time. The caregivers are there hopefully forever. So if we can empower them to deliver some of these messages, and they could continue to deliver these messages over time, we're long gone, right? Then we have made some changes in the structure of that relationship and that family, so that is going to be much more protective for girls. The other thing that we have certainly noted is that, so we've been talking about communication. Another piece of this is the relationship between moms and daughters. And we have also noted, and this was published by Aaron Emerson, that the stronger the attachment relationship between the mother and the daughter, not only are they less risky, less sexual risk, they're also less influenced by their peers. So when you strengthen that relationship with the mother, you can be protective also if your peers are engaging in negative sorts of behaviors. Thirdly, we've seen that the moms really have significant needs themselves. And we have not done as good of a job as we need to focus on what the moms need as well as the girls. However, we are currently implementing an intervention called IMARA, where we work with the mothers and the daughters to improve their relationship, improve their communication, but we also work with them separately. So we're really focusing on what moms need to do for their own health and safety, as well as what the girls should be doing for their own health and safety. And then we bring them together and we foster relationships and communication. And I guess I should say that's funded by the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. So I would say also the other things on this slide in terms of next steps, we need to be focusing on mental health and continue to. That's become a much more recognized need than when we started this work. Mental health and HIV didn't really speak to each other. That's much more commonly understood now. Also, we also know that within the context of our interventions, culture is critical. The study that I was just sharing with you, IMARA, it's very much rooted in sort of African-American pride and female pride. And I think the messages are much stronger when they're delivered that way. And then, of course, there's need for structural interventions. And I'm sure that many, many people at this conference have been talking about that, all the structural factors that impact health, both in terms of the environment and poverty and neighborhoods, and so here we list some with that are relevant to youth. And then finally, I would just emphasize that, you know, we're learning a lot about the role of PrEP and treatment as prevention. And I think that's probably going to be a very interesting direction, particularly for young Black African American women. And Dr. Fletcher is someone who's really starting to do work in that area around, you know, how do we decide who gets PrEP? If we know PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, some of you may not be as familiar with it, it's very clear that it prevents transmission of HIV, but it's restricted to, we now only prescribe it for the groups we consider most at risk. Because it's complicated. You have to take it every day. You're not actually infected, so you're taking a medicine in anticipation of avoiding it. You know, it's complex, but you know, if we know that African American women are at high risk, at what point do we decide they should get this medication? And so that's a very interesting area of development. So again, I of course have to thank our Healthy Youth Program and our funders. Nikki put up a slide with lots of individuals who've contributed to this work. There are hundreds of individuals who've contributed to Healthy Youth Program that I don't have the space or the slides to actually put all their names on it, but they certainly are, we are incredibly grateful to them for all of the work that they've done and the families and the youth who have participated. So I think I'll end there, and I'm happy to take questions if anybody has any. Yes.
Generalizable to the general
That's a really good question, and we struggle a little bit with that. I think it is in many ways generalizable. I think actually, if anything, it's a conservative estimate, because youth in mental health settings typically have more strained family relationships. And so if we can find that even in the context of these sort of strained interpersonal family relationships where there tends to be a lot of conflict, by the time they get to mental health settings and mental health clinics, there's usually significant conflict that's driving it, especially externalizing problem. That if we can find within that context that the mother-daughter communication is important for 2 years later, my guess is it would be an even stronger effect within families where you're already starting with a positive relationship. That's the trick, is to sort of try to strengthen that relationship so that when there's communication, it's received well and it's received positively and it's credible, right? If you don't get along with your mother, most of what she says you're not going to listen to, right? Even for those who do get along with their mother in their adolescence, they don't want to listen to their mothers. But, you know, so in my view, I think actually it's almost a more conservative estimate. But, of course, that said, it is a sample of mental health. It is outpatient. So, you know, when we think about, you know, who comes for outpatient services, we know there are many, many other kids who need services. In fact, I think that the estimates are crazy. I don't have it offhand, but the number that actually needs services that have problems don't receive it. So it's a fine line, I think. Thank you. Other questions? Yes.
So the study focuses on the mother-daughter relationship. I'm wondering if it matters at all how educated the mother was about some of these kinds of behaviors, and that came up in the study. I know you said that, for instance, the frequency of the conversation, you know, the mother said, you know, sometimes not being helpful with the quality, but
right, so that's a good question. So the questions that we asked, you might be better able to, in terms of, so there's two questions I think you're reflecting. One is, what was that measure? And so is it really just a reflection of something that you're capturing in the relationship? So some examples of items that went into that measure is, my mother wants to know my questions about sexual topics. My mother tries to understand how I feel about these topics. I can ask the questions. I really want to know about topics like this. So that's like the adolescent version. The mother's version said things like, I want to know my daughter's questions about sexual topics. I try to understand how my daughter feels about topics like this. My adolescent can ask me questions she really wants to know about topics like this. So they aren't actually questions that ask for facts. It's more about process. So that, in terms of the education of the mothers, I don't know that, you know, that that's as relevant to these types of questions. Does it reflect a more positive adolescent mother-daughter relationship? It might. I don't remember the correlation between. So we have measures of, like, acceptance and rejection. Actually, we might know that from the. It's positively. How strong is that correlation, do you think? Do you remember? So a stronger mother-daughter relationship is associated with more open mother-daughter communication, which you would kind of expect. But I'm not sure that we don't have that the relationship itself is predicting sexual risk, right?
But you have mentioned about it can be acknowledged.
We really never looked at it
as well. Yeah.
So, yeah. Thank you. And you should open questions. You can ask questions of anybody on the group here if you have any. Yes?
You had mentioned about the issue of PrEP and to whom it will be available. Is there any further inquiries around that?
Do you want to talk about that?
In terms of from At present, the emphasis is on males having sex with men.
Right.
So the question is, you know, what the opening there involves for other people.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. In the CDC, they define high-risk populations. And I also recently talked to a private officer who said that African-American women are adolescents, aren't considered high-risk unless you add these additional layers like mental health. We talked potentially about women who've been diagnosed with sexually transmitted infections. So there's ways to include African-American women, but you know, my focus right now, I'm actually recruiting from the MARA project, looking at moms and daughters and their perceptions around clinical trial participation, because that's sort of the next phase, looking at injectables and vaginal rings, and whether or not moms would be willing to allow permission for these daughters to participate in these studies. So that's one area that I'm looking at. But yes, the utilization piece as it stands, you know, without fitting the criteria that the CDC has outlined, and African Americans, first of all, we don't have guidelines for African American adolescents. Adolescents in general, we don't have guidelines for adolescents. Adolescents are not included in the PrEP guidelines for adults. But yeah, in the future, you know, there's testing going on. There's civil HOSIC projects prepared, which is including young African American men who have sex with men. So there's definitely studies in the pipeline to test these different ways of delivering PrEP to adolescents. But
I would also add that they're starting to do some of this work in Africa with the women because the rates are so high. And so they're more willing to say that's a really high-risk group, so we're going to test out these procedures. What they found in an early study called FemPrep was that women reported that they took it as they were supposed to, and it didn't predict HIV infection. So they went back to the women. Like there was no like association. So you said you took it, you were just as likely to get HIV as if you said you didn't take it. So they went back to the women and did these qualitative interviews and discovered that the women said, well, I didn't really take it because you told me it might not be effective and too many structural problems to taking it. And so in fact, what we now know is that if you take it, it is protective. So then the next step was to figure out how do we get women to take it, you know, to protect themselves. So in Africa, they're much more willing to do that right now, and there are a lot of people sort of exploring that. But here in the States, it's not really available, and it's controversial.
And now there's campaigns actually in Chicago, one will be marked that, you know, provide people with education about PrEP for African American heterosexual women, as well as some of the other high-risk populations. So, I mean, people definitely recognize that as a potential
population for
refugees, but
we
definitely need more
working
advocacy behind it.
Thank you. Yes?
I have a question going back to the study about the peer risk profile in sexual behaviors. Dr. Adele, I was wondering if you could talk more about the conceptual reason behind using marijuana use as that sex for your outcome,
as opposed to maybe some other measure of time sexual behavior, and whether or not you think that another outcome might be related to those peer risk profiles.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I in my work I use a lot of different outcomes. Right now I'm interested in marijuana use because of the normativity of this particular substance for youth, and particularly for African Americans. I'm in Washington State currently, where marijuana is actually legal, right? Not for youth, but it is legal. And, you know, Ohio is voting this week, and so the normativity around marijuana is for adolescents is something that we, those of us who are studying adolescents, are starting to look at. African American youth are more likely to use marijuana than alcohol. So alcohol use, that, you know, might be interesting, but it's not as prevalent. So I was interested in not just whether they use condoms or whether or not they have had multiple partners, but I wanted to look at the intersection between a pretty prevalent drug for the population and risky sex, because it's hard to have safe sex when you're hot.
So I have a particular interest in marijuana use, which is why I looked at that. But I think we, as a nation, will need to start looking, honestly, at marijuana use specifically, given the kind of, it's not meth, it's not heroin, right? It seems to be viewed as much more normative and safe for a lot of youth. It's not that big of a deal, honestly, right? And even while I was giving a talk, I said weed at last set, right? That just shows how kind of like normative it is. So I have a particular interest in marijuana. So it's just my interest mostly, but I do think, honestly, it's something that we should start paying a lot of attention to, because we also know from the other end of it that we're not entirely sure it's safe, you know, for adolescents in terms of brain development and impulse control. So I think that's an area where we should start actually looking at for these youth, and particularly for youth who use it quite frequently.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I want to thank my collaborators and all of you for hanging in there with us, and enjoy the rest of the conference.